It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, Congress has been racing against the clock to avert a looming shutdown of the Department of Homeland Security. We get details from a reporter on the Hill who's watching this issue.
First, it's Food Friday, and this week we're learning how to up our game in the kitchen with the experts at America's Test Kitchen.
We are hopefully nearing the end of winter, but the cold temperatures are still going strong here in Wisconsin. Winter is a great time to cook with a crock pot or a slow cooker, so we invited experts from America's Test Kitchen to join us and explain how to make the most of the meals we make in the crock pot.
Julia Cullen Davison is here. She is the executive food editor for the book division of America's Test Kitchen, and she's the on-screen test cook for America's Test Kitchen and Cook's Country. She's also one of the editors of Slow Cooker Revolution. You can get that book as a thank you gift for your pledge of $200 or more at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Julia, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
So crockpots have had a bit of a resurgence in the past several years. It seemed like they were passé, they were done, they were from the past. They're back big time now. What is it that people love so much about crockpots?
Yeah, you're right. They're becoming hip, if you can believe it. And there's some fancy ones out there. All-Clad has one. It's very good looking. It's a nice addition to your counter, although you don't need to spend that much. Of course, we do all our testings. But I think the appeal is the whole, I hate to borrow the phrase, but set it and forget it. It's the convenience. It's the everyone's, you know, busy, everyone's working, everyone's dealing with, well, a lot of us are dealing with snow, and kids are in school, and it's hard. You really want to put dinner on the table, and you want to have that time to sit down, but no, you know, it's harder and harder to find that time to cook dinner. And so the idea of putting all the food in this one machine, turning it on, and then coming home and having dinner done is too good to be true. You know, it is just so appealing. And I think over the years, because this appliance has been around for so long, we've learned a thing or two about how to use it and how to make it work. Because I think in the beginning, things turned out pretty watery and pretty bland. But nowadays, they're a bit more powerful. They can do some browning. And so that's what I think the appeal is overall.
Yeah, but with that simplicity, as you say, there's maybe an assumption that crockpot cooking is going to come out pretty good, and that's as good as it's going to get. Is it worth taking a little time, putting a little extra effort in to make really good stuff in the crockpot?
Yes, definitely. Any extra time, prep, browning you do before you put the food in the crockpot, you will definitely see on the other end. However, this is our third slow cooker cookbook. And so when we do our books and we send our recipes out, we encourage people to get back to us with their comments. And the comments after our first book was, the food tastes amazing, but it took too long to get it into the crock pot. Even if it was half an hour, they didn't want to, you know, no one wants to brown in the morning or do whatever. So how can you do that, but more quickly? And so our second book was all fast recipes, and the goal was 10 or 15 minutes till you can press the start button. This book, this healthy book, we did a combination of fast start and putting a little more time in. And sometimes, especially if you're dealing with healthy food, you need that little extra bump of flavor from browning or what have you, because there's not a lot of fat to cover up a thin flavor, which is often what crockpot recipes do. You know, you throw in a bunch of butter and cheese, anything tastes good.
I've gotten good results using beans, but what I've heard is that if you really want to do the best stuff, the best tasting results in your crock pot, you should be cooking with meat, because what it does is it gets really, really tender. Is that true?
Yeah, it does. So meat, the more quickly you cook meat, the tougher it can get. And so that's why when you think of steaks, the cheap steaks, the less expensive steaks that don't have all the fat and marbling throughout, they can taste pretty tough and rubbery. And the same can happen for chicken if you overcook it. Of course, you know, you combat that on steaks because you have them medium rare, right? But you can't do that with chicken. You got to cook it all the way through. And so then you're really battling some tough stuff. But if you cook stuff slowly and you give the proteins more time to cook, it winds up holding on to more moisture and the proteins are a little less tough. So you wind up with juicier results. And in fact, before this book, I wasn't a huge fan. Now, after this book, I am more of a fan. And I actually do some chicken recipes at home because chicken, boneless, skinless breasts, right? They come out so juicy. It's incredible. And also fish. The thing about fish is it has a really short cooking time. And when you extend the time, things are not only more tender, but you nail the doneness more. You have, you have a minute, maybe a couple seconds to nail the doneness of a cod fillet before it overcooks and turns to rubber. In the slow cooker, that is extended to 5 or 10 minutes for you to catch it at that right time. So it's a little more convenient and, I think, a little more foolproof.
That said, I know I have managed to overcook chicken, even on low, in a crock pot. So what's the window is wider, but how do we avoid overcooking a cut of meat in the crock pot?
Yeah, I think a couple things. I think all crock pots are not the same. And, of course, in the test kitchen, we test everything. And so when we develop a recipe, we then take that recipe and we retest it in 4 other brands and sizes of crock pots because some are really fast, some are really slow, some are really small, so things are stacked on top of each other so they don't cook as evenly, so you need a bit longer. And this all plays out in how tender the food is at the end. And so when you see a time in a recipe for a crock pot or a slow cooker, really, is what they should be called, because crock pot's a brand name, right? And so there's lots of people who make these slow cookers, not just crock pot. But when you see a time range in a recipe, our time ranges are about an hour. And it'll say for chicken, 2 or 3 hours on low. Now, people might interpret that as, oh, it'll be done between hours 2 and 3, and whatever in that time range is convenient for me is when I'll take it out. Well, that's not quite true. If you have a crock pot that runs a little hot, you should go on the two-hour mark. If your crock pot runs a little slow, you should go towards probably the 3-hour mark. And the more you use your crock pot, you'll get a sense of how it works. So that's what the time ranges are, and you really just can't let it sit in there. It will overcook pretty quickly.
Now, on the cover of your book, Slow Cooker Revolution, there is a delicious-looking piece of lasagna layered with ricotta cheese and sausage and tomato sauce. And it's one of those things you think, I can't cook lasagna in a slow cooker, and yet there it is. It looks great. So how can you pull off something like that in a slow cooker?
Yeah, you can. The thing about casseroles, so if you think about a slow cooker, it's a moist heat environment, which means you add a lot of liquid into it. And if you've used them, you know a lot of liquid comes out of the meat. So you put in chicken breasts with just a little bit of sauce, and what you get is like two, three cups of sauce at the end. Same with beef. With casseroles, that's not what's going to happen. In fact, the reverse will happen. The casserole will suck up all that liquid and will get really dry and start to burn. And so this is what happens over and over. And we found that you have to add more liquid, obviously, to the crockpot casserole. But also, you need to line the insert with foil because one side of the pot will be hotter than the other. So you know where the dials are or your digital display is. There's no heating element there. But on the opposite side, on the back side, there's a lot of heating elements. So things are always burning on the back side. So you lay in a couple sheets of foil along the back side. That prevents it from burning. And then if you do a little sling action with the foil before you layer the stuff in, you can get it out in a pretty good one piece.
A little fling action?
A little fling action.
Sounds fun.
We're talking to Julia Collin-Davison from America's Test Kitchen about how to make the most of the meals we make in slow cookers.
And we'd love to have you in on this conversation. What is your favorite slow cooker meal? What's your go-to crockpot dish? And what are your secrets for cooking in that slow cooker? What questions do you have about how to get the best results from your slow cooker? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our discussion now with Julia Collin-Davison from America's Test Kitchen. She's with us to talk about how to make the most out of our crockpot meals.
And we're taking your calls, too. Do you have questions about how to cook with slow cookers? And what is your favorite slow cooker recipe? Do you have a signature dish that you like to do, a particular meat that always turns out well, or maybe some, bumps in the road when it comes to this and you'd like to get over them? Call in and share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Before we go to a caller, Julia, we shared a recipe from the book, Pork Loin with Cranberries and Orange. That's on the Central Time Facebook page. Could you tell us about this one?
oh, it's good and it's easy. This is one of those recipes where we thought, let's respond to those readers who want something that's really easy to get into the pot and press the go button. So it is a pork loin, a boneless pork loin. And, you know, as we test everything in the test kitchen, right? So we made this recipe maybe 20, 30 times. And the first few times we did it, it was terrible. The pork loin was so overdone. People took it home anyway, mind you. There's so much leftover food here in the test kitchen. We have, as a side note, we have a whole refrigerator. It's called the leftover fridge. And everything gets packed up and everyone gets to take the food home. And so the whole company is fed. Of course, we can't donate the food because it's experimental and it's never enough of any one thing. So we do that in a separate way. But so this one wound up in the take-home fridge in the beginning of the testing process a lot. But then we realized you can only cook this kind of lean meat on low. You really can't cook it on high. And you'll see other books that say you can do this. No, don't do it. Cook it on low. Let it go slowly, only for about 4 hours. So this is not when you can set at 8 in the morning and come home at 5 or 6 and expect it to taste good. This is, you know, one where you can put it in around noon or 1 or 2 and then have dinner at, you know, anywhere between 4 and 6. The key, there's two keys here. The first, the cut of boneless pork roast you buy. If you really look at them in the supermarket, there's pretty much two kinds. One is long and narrow, and it comes from the center of the loin. And the other one is kind of shorter. It's usually a bit darker, and it comes from more the shoulder area. And if you get the short shoulder area one, it will taste so much better. There's a little bit of extra fat in there, and it really does make a difference in how it tastes on the other side. And it's just a matter of going through the packages and looking for the right ones. Of course, the shorter ones also fit in the slow cooker a little bit better. Otherwise, you're going to have to sort of curl it around in there to make it fit. And the other thing is you got to brown it. Just a couple minutes in a hot skillet, you got to get that browning on it, or else it'll look really awful, and you won't have enough color. You know, we had a lot of, like, really pale meat with this blood red sauce, and it was a little garish. And so putting a little golden color on it and getting that browning does translate to a better looking dish and a little more flavor. And then we've just put a can of whole berry cranberry sauce, some dried cranberries and orange juice and some fresh strips of orange zest, a little cinnamon in the slow cooker, and you put the browned pork loin on top, and that's it. I mean, it couldn't be easier.
It sounds delicious. Well, let's go to our callers now. Margie is joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Margie.
Hi. Great timing for this show. On March 7th, there's about 40 of us that are getting together for my mother's 90th birthday.
Oh, congrats.
And
wow.
We've got a long afternoon planned, and we've got four or five people bringing hot dishes in crock pots. And so we're still combing the recipe books to find out what to do. Are there any good potato dishes that you can do safely?
Gotcha.
You know, like a gratin or scallop or something like that?
All right. Thanks, Margie. Any good potato dishes?
Yes, we do have some good potato dishes. In fact, I'm just flipping through now. It's really easy to make scalloped potatoes, which might be kind of elegant for a party. Well, here it is, scalloped potatoes. It's 4 to 6 hours on low, and it uses russet potatoes and your classic heavy cream, a little butter, a little sharp cheddar, and Monterey Jack. And you just, as I mentioned before in the program, with casseroles, you really want to line the slow cooker insert with foil. Again, the back side of the slow cooker, the one on the opposite side of all the, you know, the digital outlet or the dials, that's the hot side, the back side. And so you want to put a couple layers of foil back on that back side. And then do what I called it a foil sling, and that's what we kind of call it around here. You lay a piece of foil that, you know, goes down, you know, covers the bottom and goes up the sides. And then when you layer all your potatoes in and you pour the cream over top and you put the cheese on, but then when you're ready to serve, you just lift up the foil on the edges like a sling, and it pulls out the scalloped potatoes all at once. Or you could just go in there with a spoon, of course. But if you pull it out at once, you could probably put it in a nice serving dish. So that's what I might consider doing if I were you.
That sounds delicious. And just real quick before we move on, how is that different than what you would do if you just cooked it in, you know, a ceramic dish in the oven?
Well, it's slower. I mean, you would never cook scalloped potatoes 4 to 6 hours in the oven, right? So that would be more like an hour, and you do a combination of covered and uncovered.
And how about the results?
Yeah, the results are absolutely comparable. I wouldn't say that the oven is better or different than the slow cooker. They both take equally as good, but with the slow cooker, you have that built-in hands-off, and your oven is still free, especially if you're having a party with a lot of people. Having your oven free and having your side dishes just doing their own thing off to the side on the counter in a slow cooker can be really valuable in terms of saving space.
Mm.
And Julia, we've hit the meat and potatoes here. Any great veggie, either entrees or side dishes that are perfect for a slow cooker that you could mention as we wrap up?
Oh, yeah. In fact, our new book, The Healthy Slow Cooker, has a whole vegetarian chapter. And all sorts of whole grains, wheat, berries, quinoa, lentils, they all work really well in the slow cooker because, again, that low, slow heat really ensures that all the grains get evenly cooked at the same time, none burst open, and none get overcooked while others stay crunchy. You can do kind of a faux roasted acorn squash in there. We did this amazing, it's a stuffed eggplant, and it has some pretty unique flavors. It has a cigar masala and tomatoes and pine nuts. And you put the filling on the bottom of the insert, and then you invert small halved eggplants on the top, and you
wow.
cook it that way.
And Julia, thank you. You've made us really hungry. We've been talking to Julia Collin-Davison, food editor for the book division of America's Test Kitchen. The book we've been talking about, Slow Cooker Revolution. You can get your own copy of this book, by the way, with your pledge of $20 a month or more. That's $240. With your pledge to support Wisconsin Public Radio right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. A lot of good inspiration here. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
With a looming deadline, Congress has been working today to avoid a partial shutdown of Homeland Security operations.
The Senate passed a bill earlier that would have funded the department and keep funding for President Obama's immigration changes, which has been the sticking point.
Well, that bill passed the Senate easily. All eyes are now in the House, where many Republicans have vowed to reject that Senate bill. One possible outcome could be a short-term funding package that saves the debate for next month. With us now is Lauren Fox, a staff correspondent for National Journal, who's been on the Hill covering this issue. Lauren, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So this one has been a moving target throughout the day today. What is the latest news on this Homeland Security funding?
Well, the House of Representatives is upstairs right now as we speak, voting on legislation. Essentially, what we'll see in the next few minutes is whether they are willing to move forward with a short-term continuing resolution. At the moment, that looks to be the option on the table from the House of Representatives. But Democrats are whipping against that, and House Speaker John Boehner, it's unclear if he has the votes from his own conference to move forward. As we know, in the past, getting enough Republican votes has been a stumbling block at times for the House.
So this short-term funding bill wouldn't tackle the sticking point for Republicans, President Obama's executive action on immigration. Is that right?
Correct. And here is that with a little more time, this might have more time to play out in the courts, and maybe that would take a little pressure off Capitol Hill to solve this issue. That's what I heard from Congressman Tom Cole from Oklahoma. He was making the point, basically defending leadership's decision to do a short-term stopgap resolution. Because a lot of us here on the Hill are wondering, well, if we don't deal with this now, what will the outcome be in 3 weeks? Will anything really have changed politically?
So I guess there's some kind of vote hustling going on. Speaker Boehner hoping to have enough votes from Republicans, even if he loses some of the conservatives who are against this, and some votes from Democrats to make up the difference?
Exactly. And I mean, I think Nancy Pelosi is urging her members not to get on board with this short-term funding bill. The thinking is that maybe House Speaker John Boehner wouldn't be able to get the votes alone, and then Democrats might have more leverage to get that full funding bill that passed out of the Senate this morning.
And so on the Senate side, has there been any indication of whether Republicans in the Senate, I guess Democrats in the Senate, would bring that short-term plan to a vote if it comes to them from the House?
Yeah, Senator Chuck Schumer said that that was an emergency last-ditch option that Democrats would entertain. So it appears that there might be some ability and breathing room to avoid a shutdown. But again, you know, 3 weeks isn't a lot of time. What will happen in terms of the politics? These sticking points are still going to continue to exist between Republicans wanting to defund the president's executive action and Democrats standing firm against that. Those battle lines aren't going to change over 3 weeks. I think that's what's really interesting about the short-term bill. A lot of Republicans are saying, look, it's time to move on. We want to continue governing. We want to be able to prove that we have the propensity to govern like we promised on the campaign trail in 2014.
And something like that is what passed in the Senate earlier, right? They passed what has been called a clean bill, allowing, I think, a year of funding for Homeland Security and not tackling this immigration thing?
Through September, yes. The argument basically being that this is up for the courts to decide now. The president's made an unconstitutional move, is what Republicans would tell you. But the courts are ultimately going to be the ones to decide. You know, Mitch McConnell is very pragmatic. He doesn't want the Republican Party heading into a presidential cycle in 2016 being blamed for a partial government shutdown.
Now, that word shutdown has been controversial among some Republicans, including Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson, who say, okay, yeah, some people will be furloughed. Most or all vital services, people show up to work. They won't be paid until this is resolved. It isn't really a shutdown, so maybe we shouldn't be too scared about going over the brink. Is there a lot of sympathy for that line of reasoning?
Well, it's interesting. I was at the CPAC yesterday, which is a conservative political convention held outside of Washington, D.C., and I was speaking with some members who were there and some attendees who were there, and they made a very similar argument. Look, they're not worried about a government shutdown. They're more worried about the president's executive action, which kind of shows you John Boehner's position here in Congress, which is that base voters don't care as much about a Department of Homeland Security partial shutdown, especially because TSA agents still have to show up to work, border agents still have to show work, as they are about the president exerting his executive authority and, as they see it, changing the immigration law.
And is that leading to tensions among Republicans, some thinking along those lines, challenging this executive action is the most important thing from our base, others looking to general elections for the Senate, for the House, for the presidency, for that matter, in 2016, saying we don't want to be the party that gets the word shutdown labeled on it?
Exactly. I think this is sort of the fundamental divide between conservative Republicans in the House of Representatives who are going to go back to districts where they're completely safe from anything but maybe a primary challenger, and the difference between them and folks who, like Ron Johnson, are up for re-election in 2016 and might have a more difficult time if the government shuts down. I think the optics of that can be very difficult to weather. Although some would tell you that in October of 2013, there was a government shutdown, and look who won the majority in the Senate in 2014, just over a year later. It was the Republicans. Some would tell you that maybe they don't have the political consequences that strategists might want to scare Republicans into thinking they have.
Are there Republicans, especially in the House, looking back at Eric Cantor losing in a surprise primary challenge and thinking, I don't want that to be me, so I'm going to go ahead with this challenge to the president?
Well, I think that there's a little bit of a divide about whether or not Eric Cantor's loss was really related to him not being conservative enough on immigration, or whether it might have just been a disconnection with the district. But certainly a primary challenge is always a fear for a lot of these members of Congress who are going back to very conservative districts. It's why so many of these hardliners in the Republican Party hold their positions against the president. They're not willing to take a chance on a primary challenge.
So some observers have said, pointed out that Speaker Boehner, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell haven't been talking much directly on this, saying there's a rift is maybe a strong word, but some mismatch in their respective strategies. Are you seeing any signs of that?
Well, certainly, I think there's always been tension between the Senate and the House of Representatives. And while I do think a little bit of Boehner's statement that he hadn't spoken with McConnell in 2 weeks, he said that on Wednesday morning during a conference meeting, was aimed at ensuring his confreres that he wasn't making a backroom deal with Mitch McConnell. The other side of this is there's tension between these two houses. There always have been, even when the Democrats were in control of the Senate, Republicans in control of the House. But some of those tensions haven't evaporated just because Republicans control all of Capitol Hill. There is a little bit of tension between McConnell's trying to explain to Republicans in the House, look, I'm still short the 60 vote threshold to overcome a lot of filibusters here. I'm going to need to be working with more moderate legislation than you guys are in the House of Representatives, where you have a very strong majority. So I think there's a little bit of tension there. There's a little bit of tension about who gets to sort of determine the playing rules here. We saw Mitch McConnell moving forward with his clean DHS bill, and then House Speaker John Boehner not coming forward with a full DHS funding bill, but just this three-week bill. So I think there's certainly a little bit of tension developing there.
Is there thought at the back of everyone's mind here, or maybe at the front, of the much sought-after Hispanic voter in this country after the 2012 elections? Republicans, one of their laments after losing in the presidential race was, we need to do more to reach out to Hispanic voters. President Obama's seen some pretty good numbers with them lately. Is that a part of the debate on people's minds here?
Well, I think in the House of Representatives, it's much less present on the tops of minds of Republican congressmen, and that's because so many of their districts contain so few minority voters. This isn't a major issue for them. This isn't something that they've had to worry much about. But in the Senate, it's become a much more important issue for many voters or many members who are on the fence. I mean, we've seen the way that Senator Jeff Flake has voted, the way that Senator John McCain has been talking about this issue. Certainly for members who come from states with high Hispanic populations, these issues, you know, they're much more difficult to navigate around. They're much more careful about how they talk about these issues.
So as you said, the House is voting on this short-term extension. It would then go to the Senate. Is the thought that they're going to actually get this thing done by midnight tonight?
It's possible. I mean, I think I'll have to run back upstairs and literally look at the voting counter right now. But, I mean, I think it's possible that this could get done before midnight. If the House fails to pass a short-term CR, certainly this is back in limbo, and we'll be watching closely for that.
All right, Lauren, I'll let you run back upstairs right now. Thank you so much for joining us today.
All right, thank you. I appreciate it. Bye.
That's Lauren Fox, staff correspondent for the National Journal.